So we're on number 26. Remember? And we did the first, we did to when the Buddha had, we did like one, two, three pages, two and one, two, well, double pages, one, two, three, four, five pages. We're on the sixth page of that. Do you want to go back over it, or shall we just carry on from where we were?
I think it'd be good to go over it.
Go over it? Yeah. Because it's a long one,
yeah.
And there's stuff in the beginning that they talk about at the end, just briefly, so. So is that good? Do you have a text, my man? Do you guys want text, or you've got photographic memory so you can remember it from your last lifetime, or? He's got text there.
The extra ones, or?
Yeah.
Yep.
Have you got an extra text there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was hunting in there, and I couldn't remember what I was hunting for when it was, so.
Yeah.
Numero 26.
Yeah.
Halfway through, we really raced.
Because I kept looking back at the
Anteal
thinking of how fast that one.
Yeah, we went through 25 at a pretty good clip there. Simile of the... Was that the simile of the snake, or that was the anthill? No, it
the
was
bait.
The relay chariots.
The bait.
The bait.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are all sort of leading along the same way, like why you do the path. And now in this one, he's talking about the noble search. He's talking about what the path is, and this is the first of a series. And in this one, it's one of the times that he lays out how his path went. And in this one, he talks about the two main teachers that he had. But he doesn't talk about his explorations of controlling desire by cutting down his diet and stuff like that. But in this one, that one of the reasons I like this, I'm attached to this one, is because in this one he actually mentions his very first discourse, which was on his way, you know, where he meets this Brahmin who says, "You got a nice shine to you," and he tells the Brahmin why he does, and the Brahmin says, "Oh well, good for you. Excuse me, I got to go home." And so you don't find that one written very often. It's nice to know, you know, if you ever want to know where something is, and there's so many sutras, have some idea where. And I'm not just making it up, it's actually. So Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So, number 26, the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the noble search. Arya means noble, right? Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove and Anathapindika's Park. I wonder why they have a footnote after "Thus Have I Heard." Shall we check it out? 297. This title follows the Upalitas Text Society and SBJ editions of Majjhima Nikaya. The BBS edition, and both the Polytext Society and BBS editions refer to this discourse as the Parapasarasi Sutta, the heap of snares, with reference to the simile in verse 32 and 33. Okay. No, we cared about that, yeah?
Sister, when you refer to it as a park, would that be a park like what we know as a park?
Yeah, a kind of a large acreage that when some quite wealthy person found the Buddha's teaching useful or decided that either because it meant something to him personally or it meant something to his family, or he figured that he'd get a lot more social standing and merit,
mm-hmm.
he would donate a big parcel of land. It probably cut down his income tax. So it would be a big parcel of land with a river running through it and some trees, and it was used for, like Jetta Grove was one that was given to him in one park, and that was used, that was given for the Buddha's use, and so it became...
Okay, so it would be like for the Buddha or visiting teachers or
yeah,
something like
but
that.
Probably there would be, by the time the Buddha was around this age, there would be so many followers that there was probably a continuous camp of monks and a few nuns sitting there, practicing there, year round, you know?
Oh, I see, okay.
So, because it would be given for the Buddha's teaching, so,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, okay.
Thus have I heard, yeah. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Sawati for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, "Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could to hear such a talk, Friend Ananda. Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahmin Ramakas hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips." "Yes, friend," they replied. Then when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Sawati and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, let us go to the eastern park, to the palace of Migara's mother, for the day's abiding." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern park, the palace of Migara's mother, for the day's abiding. I always wish I had one of those little "you are here" maps so I could see.
Yeah.
Because they're walking, right? So it had to be. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up from out of the water and stood in one robe drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion." The Blessed One consented in silence. Then the Blessed One went to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were sitting together in the hermitage, discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One stood outside the door, waiting for the discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Venerable Sir, our discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself." Then the Blessed One arrived. "Good bhikkhus, it is fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss the Dhamma. When you gather together, bhikkhus," this is one of the most famous little quotes, "you should do either of two things, hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence." It's like speak Dhamma or maintain silence. That's often you hear that quote from different teachers or in books and things. So that's where it comes from. Oh, in the footnote, shall we check it out? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 298. The second jhana and one's basic meditation are both called noble silence. So the noble silence is be in a state of absorption, or talk about Dharma. Meditate and talk about Dharma. Be in meditation or talk about Dharma. I didn't know that. That's nice to know.
Well, didn't the Buddha say that you should maybe that's the same thing. Yeah, to try to speak, you could just speak about the Dharma, nothing else.
But I hadn't heard it. I hadn't heard noble silence.
Oh, I see. Okay,
defined this way. Yeah.
All right, okay.
So, like noble silence in this case, according to M.A. What is M.A.? I always mean to look it up, but I never do. Mystic abbreviation. See it there? Majjhima Nikaya Atta Katha. Any idea, anybody? Okay. Okay. Bhikkhus, there are these two kinds of search. This is called two kinds of search, this next section. Because there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here, someone, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. Isn't that lovely? Being subject to impermanence, he seeks something that is subject to impermanence, right? Being subject to self-grasping, he seeks something that is subject to self-grasping. So all of those are caught in, they're going to change, they're going to pass, they're going to create suffering. It's such a nice, clean definition, I think. It's just like right there. And what may be said to be subject to birth? Wife and children are subject to birth. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to birth. I think this is very interesting. These objects of attachment is when you're attached to these objects. And there, of course, is a footnote, 299. Upadi, the root meaning is foundation, basis, ground. In the commentaries, various kinds of upadi are enumerated, among them the five aggregates, objects of sensual pleasure, defilements, and kama. Najanamikaya renders the term consistently, Nyanamoli renders the term consistently throughout as essentials of existence, which is often obscures its clear contextual meaning. I have tried to capture the several connotations of the word by rendering it objects of attachment, where its objective meaning is prominent as it is here, and its attachment where its subjective meaning is prominent. At Majjhima Nikaya 26, verse 19, Nibbana is called the relinquishing of all attachments, with both meanings intended.
In my translation, it instead of objects of attachment, he's got acquisitions.
For what, objects?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's acquisitions, just, yeah. Because that's actually more clear.
It is.
Because sometimes it isn't an object so much as it is a mind state you're attached to, or, you know, like a position, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, like not the wife, but the fact that you have a family, or, you know, right? I think that's just like so important to actually look at and see, okay, something that you can gain means you can also lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything possible that does not depend on outer circumstances of gain and loss? Is it possible somewhere in this being that there is a path that just sidesteps acquisition? That's a really interesting question, isn't it? It's not a question that in our day we particularly like to ask ourselves during the afternoon break or anything, you know, but what an interesting question. People say to me, so you really take Buddhism very seriously, you really have dedicated your life to it. And I say, yeah, every once in a while I have dedicated my life to it. Maybe if I'm lucky, 3 times a week, you know, will hit me out of nowhere. Because it's not easy to do, is it? We just like slipping back into what's comfortable or is an identity is like an acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Just go around that corner and don't even notice half the time you've done it. But how profound to actually consider to make that something that you focus on once a day. Am I interested in something that's impermanent or, you know, just as a question. Might be quite an interesting question. So like I said, because I do ask myself that question, maybe 2 or 3 times a week it happens. You know? Which is 2 or 3 times more than it would otherwise. You know? It's not a matter of perfection, is it? It's a matter of clarity of aspiration. Straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all a bunch of idiots. I mean, we're all a bunch of idiots.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something we're not doing right. All of us. When I look down to push the button, I don't see the guy behind me that wishes I'd change lanes, so, you know, so he could pass me, you know? There's always something. So to how to like bring the consciousness to question about outside of the box, is there anything? These objects of attachment are subject to birth, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. And what may it be said to be subject to aging? Wife and children are subject to aging. Men and women, slaves, goats, sheep, fowls, pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, and mares. Gold and silver, subject to aging. These objects of attachment are subject to aging, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to aging, seeks what is also subject to aging. And what may be said to be subject to sickness? Wife and children are subjects to sickness. Men, women, slaves, goats, sheep, fowls, and pigs, elephants, Cattle, horses, and mares are subject to sickness. Cats, dogs, children. Oh, we already got children. These objects of attachment are subject to sickness, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sickness, seeks what is also subject to sickness. And what may be said to be subject to death? Wife and children are subject to death, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, and mares are subject to death. These objects of attachment are subject to death, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. And what may be said to be subject to sorrow? Wife and children are subject to sorrow, men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares are subject to death, sorrow. These objects of attachment are subject to sorrow. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sorrow, seeks what is also subject to sorrow. And what may be said to be subject to defilement, wife and children are subject to defilement, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to defilement. These objects of attachment are subject to defilement. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, utterly committed to them, being himself subject to defilement, seeks what is also subject to defilement. This is the ignoble search. So you can see how easily someone could misunderstand the Buddhist teaching as being nihilistic. Negating
mm-hmm.
any value in anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because it's not saying that those things are wrong or that, you know, I am right if I don't, is saying that they are subject to that, especially if there's attachment. One can suffer from that. Right? That whatever comes into being is conditioned, and as conditioned, it's subject to old age, sickness, and death. Sorrow, lamentation, grief, and despair. Like, we all know that. But to actually name it as a philosophy, like step one, there is dissatisfactoriness. Start there. And so that's a big leap, isn't it, for our culture to take that step.
Well, it's like you get a cold, a flu, and you become attached to it.
Or you become attached to not having a cold. More likely, although some people do get attached to being sick.
Well, you get attached to it by thinking about it all the time, don't you?
Yeah, and so therefore it's more suffering than it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to allude to. That.
Yeah, I see where you're going.
Hanging on to it, it's clinging to it. I'm sick.
Yeah, ho-hum.
My nose is running, my eyes are hurting.
Yeah, ho-hum. Kind of like that, eh? Ho-hum, I'm sick, ho-hum. Isn't everybody sick at some time? Ho-hum, nothing special, ho-hum.
Yeah, if we did that.
Yeah, it would make it easier.
Yeah, we tend to get over it. Not
maybe.
Wallow in our...
We wouldn't wallow in it. We wouldn't suffer as much.
Exactly.
Maybe we'd die, but we would go out happily.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be going, oh, who did this to me? You know?
Yeah.
How could this happen to me?
What did I do wrong?
What did I do wrong? Big one. Big one, eh?
Yeah.
Need, eh?
Yeah.
I mean, when you actually just look directly at it, it's such common sense. But when you're subjected to it...
But as you're subjected to it, you get more subjected to it.
You get more subjective. You start thinking, oh, what did I do wrong? Or,
okay.
It's like personal. It's not, oh, yeah, this is the nature of existence. Okay? So then the defenses or the cover-ups or, you know, and then we're caught.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, whatever arises in the course of existence is not special to me or someone else. If I have really excellent health all my life, that's not, you know, my fault or my right, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not that either, but when I actually start thinking it, there is an I who is that. Yeah, it's a little iffy there, doesn't it? I should be this way, I shouldn't be this way, or my whole family is like that, so that's why I'm like that, you know? As if there were some permanent state. Doesn't matter how healthy you are, like the you're not going to be around next time the continents move. You know? How your bod is made, damn. I know, I'm sorry to break that news to you.
I was looking forward to that.
Boom, what was that?
Oh yeah, I was wrong, see? That's how trustworthy this thing is. Did you want us to add more? I appreciate your comments.
No, I just see it. Just looking back at my life in the last while, I see it perpetuating. As the more I get, the more I allow myself to get away from the practice, that I get busy and
mm-hmm.
work is 12 hours a day. Whoa. I don't have time. I'm tired, and it just couples and couples and couples itself.
It does, doesn't it?
Like a train, and it's been, and then it gets to the point that I get really, then I get sick.
Yeah.
And now I've had a cold for 2 months, and you know I'm okay. When is this going to go away? Well, I'll go to the pool, come out, forget my hat. Now I got a cold again. Yeah, and now I got okay. Now I got it for another 3 weeks or a month. I can't go back to the pool to exercise. So I put on more weight. And blah 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 blah.
Well,
blah.
Exactly.
Yeah, work more so I get less sleep.
Get tired. Get a cold.
Yeah, and then get really sick, and then say, okay, well, maybe I should go start exercising and
build up my health.
Sit again.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden things start getting better, and then oh, okay, now I'm feeling better. Now I can get back into what I was doing.
Yeah,
before.
I got to finish that work that I was.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it, how we do that?
Oh yeah, and then lose sight of.
And how unconscious it is, how unconscious we are in that.
Yeah.
That's sort of what I'm pointing to when I say, you know, maybe 3 times a week I actually look outside of myself in a real way where the mind is actually really caring.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm pessimistic, but I think I probably do it more. I think most people probably average maybe 0.1, and the Dharma students probably average 2 on good weeks. You know? So just because of the fortune of my Dharma friends, I have this little edge at the moment, you know. When we actually can look at these things, like really look at them, not just say, yeah, I know that. And what an enormous opportunity, because that is like the whole basis of this sutra, is can you see the noble search and the ignoble search? Can you see it? Because if you can see, that's the doorway. But anyway, shall we get back to the sutra? I appreciate your comments. And what is the noble search? Here's someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the aging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Being himself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana. This is the noble search. And then the Buddha starts talking about his personal path. Because before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, sata, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Pretty clear? Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, bhikkhus, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama, the first main teacher he worked with, and said to him, "Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dharma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma." And then see, in the Buddha's time, as there is now in a lot of people unconsciously, there was starting to arise the caste system in the sense that people were born with certain abilities. It wasn't totally strong yet. It wasn't the full social system. But it was starting to get more set at the time of the Buddha. So that's part of why it says so clearly, can realize, he can soon, this Dharma is such that a wise man, like someone who's willing to listen to it and pay attention, can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge that you don't have to be born into a certain caste. For his, through direct knowledge, his own teacher's doctrine, you can learn from somebody else who knows something. You don't have to wait for another lifetime. And how often in our lives do we think that we can't do something in this lifetime? I mean, we do it too. We're just a little more sneaky about it, aren't we?
Subtle
is what we are. Thank you. As I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, "I know and see," and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it's not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma?" In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. Nothingness. So this would be the seventh jhana, where it's nothingness, where there is neither, there is no thing, no subject, no object. The fifth jhana is boundless space. The sixth jhana is boundless consciousness. The seventh jhana is nothingness, and the eighth jhana is neither perception nor non-perception. Do you have any question about that? That's pretty straightforward because we've been over it a few times. Okay. So footnote, we'll probably say that. I can't remember. 301. He taught him the seven attainments of serenity meditation, ending in the base of nothingness, the third of the four immaterial attainments. Though these attainments are spiritually exalted, they are still mundane and not in themselves directly conducive to nirvana. Not in themselves. It's very important to have an experience of consciousness without subject-object. Non-dual. Consciousness non-dual. It helps understand. It's like sticking your head a little bit out of the box when there isn't a reference. Because if there's a reference, it brings up all the conditioning, right? And all vows about, oh, I'm not going to do it that way again because I did it that way last time, or whatever. 1001 stories come riding along. There's subject-object all the time. But to have an experience where there is consciousness without object is the reason why, for example, Ayakema in her books talks about the twice liberated path, which you've heard me talking about many times, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's the path of experience, total absorption bliss, like the same thing that you get in sexual orgasm, only longer, more profound, and without having to take a shower afterward. Or to make sure, was it as good for you as it was for, you know, you not have to do any of that stuff. And therefore, not subject to those rises and falls. Because if a state, if an experience is inside your being, it's inside your being. There should be a way for you to have direct access to that experience. Is that true?
Being a feeling or...
Anything. Emotion, feeling, orgasm.
Yes, something that we consider...
Subject-object related.
Yeah, okay.
But really, if you actually train your mind in this kind of absorption, that is, you don't have to train your mind for if you're really on about that single-pointed experience of climax, right? If you just train your mind to do that without the usual little, you know, genetic coding to reproduce quickly, get that sperm out there for that egg to do its thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without the biological drive, you train yourself in calm abiding meditation, you start to experience more and more a sense of absorption. Now, that's nothing new. You know, when you paint, when you listen to music. Remember when your kids were young and you were holding them. You know, those moments of just, you know, those moments of just absorption, when you're really absorbed in a problem and you could see how to work it, you know. Do you know what I mean? Like that is that kind of bringing the mind to one point, and there's a real joyfulness in it, isn't there? So that you continue to bring the mind to one point and so that you can do it at will. And then you slightly shift the way you're looking so that you're not looking at one point, but you're looking at the space in which that one point exists and feeling that space everywhere. And you, poof, consciousness goes out of subject-object. Boundless space. Then you come out of that state again. You're back in the ordinary world, but you know that consciousness without self-grasping is a reality.
When you come back to subject to object, that's when you're coming back to what we would consider the reality.
Us sitting here right now.
Yeah, okay. From where you were.
From a state of total absorption, like we know from, for example, orgasm, or where there is no subject object, just for a flicker there, right?
Yeah.
Gone. Then, poing, back. And then, you know.
So that's what we're looking for.
Well,
the one-pointedness is what we're looking for when we're doing our meditation.
The one-pointedness is an important factor, because if the mind isn't one-pointed, it doesn't have power. But one-pointed toward what? You know, somebody who is really... Did you ever see Clockwork Orange, that movie, a long time ago? No.
Even.
Okay. You know, like sometimes do you ever see horror movies or
mm-hmm.
huh? So when you're absolutely totally fascinated and you're watching somebody who is going to be, you know, the demon who is going to go after that one thing regardless of what else happens, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there can be absorption for all kinds of things.
Yeah. Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that the absorption is going to take you to an experience of non-clinging.
An experience of which?
Non-clinging.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So that clarity of joy, of like going beyond subject-object-self, is very valuable. It's very valuable to have that experience. Then you have to turn around and see, okay, that experience does exist, but this way of experiencing it is still subject to loss. Because, you know, that experience, let me just use the crude, because you know how crude I am, the crude term of orgasm.
Yeah.
That experience where there is no subject to object, just for a moment, there's just this absolute blissful sense of union, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without particular subject and object, it does exist, but because it's dependent on circumstances, one of the kids is coming in the door or something, you know, it disappears, right?
Yeah.
So it's subject to loss. So you know that experience exists, but you know achieving it that way isn't satisfactory, because even if you get it very intense, at some point or other, it's impermanent because it's dependent on conditions.
Because the act of the sexual act is the vehicle that you're using.
Yeah, because it has a vehicle.
Yeah.
And so at some time or other, however classy it is, every vehicle will break down.
Yeah.
Right. So knowing that, you know that the state is possible, but the vehicle is not the best way to go about it. Now you start accepting the sense of that state and start asking, okay, how else could it be attained? You turn around and you start actually examining the state itself.
The state being that...
Ecstasy, whatever.
Ecstasy, that space, that
yes.
Space you're in.
Which is a mind state, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's called twice liberated in Buddhism, when people use that as their path. And Aya Kema, I've told you about her book, Who is the Self?
Mm-hmm.
Has written an excellent book on that, because that was her path. And that book is from classes that she gave that were taped on a retreat. So she's actually talking about how, I'm doing a very crude description here. But in that book, she lays it out, and it's very interesting if you're interested in trying to see how to explore the mind with the mind. You know, it's a lovely little conundrum, and she's just very clear, isn't she? You've read it, haven't you? Have any of you read it?
I know I've read Being Here, Being Nobody,
I
read a couple of books, yeah.
But Who is the Self is actually from a retreat, and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like very, very...
Well, both books I read were from.
Yeah. Really excellent. So here we are with this. So here he is. He's done, he's learned everything there is to learn about how to achieve. He's learned all this about how to achieve single-pointedness. He can name it. He can do it to a certain degree.
Okay.
Right? He can bring single-pointedness and one-pointedness, but he hasn't learned how to, so he can have an experience of boundless space, and even experience of the that consciousness is boundless, boundless consciousness, no subject object.
Okay.
Right? So he's gone that far, but then he says, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself a direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. So not just knowing it, but seeing it too, right? Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, in which way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? You abide in it. Not just know it and see it, but there's no separateness between you and this mind state."
Okay, you're abiding it, that's when you're in it.
Yeah, there's no separateness.
Okay, so you're in it and you know you're in it. Abiding, when you refer to abiding.
So do you know you're in this house all the time?
No.
It's not an issue, is it? It's an experience.
I guess I'm looking for the clarification on the word abiding.
But you're abiding in this house, aren't you, right now?
Okay, yeah. So
you know the state, you see the state, and then you abide in the state. You can go into that state and rest there without
a
problem.
Okay, now I got it.
Right?
I'm sorry for the...
No, I love questions, you know that. Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? Right? How do you sustain it? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. That is to say, the seventh jhana, the third of the four formless jhanas. I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Well, that's how he's doing it. Well, I have those. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. Suppose I try that. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in the Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge?" "That is the way, friend. It is in the way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge." "It's a gain for us, friend," this is Kalama. Alara Kalama speaking to the Buddha, the to-be Buddha. "Oh, it's a gain for us, friend. It's a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge." Oh, you're having the same experience I am. We are having the same experience. Right? Imagine how lonely this guy must have been. How wonderful to share it with someone. "And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together." Dasara Kalama, my teacher, placed me as pupil on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. But it only brings me back to this same point over and over again. It's not the end of attachment or craving. It only brings me back here again and again. I keep coming back here to sleep. Or not sleep. Or there's an I who arises here. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, I left it and went away. So 302, that is, it leads to rebirth in the plane of existence called the base of nothingness, nothingness, the objective counterpart of the seventh meditative attainment. Because when you experience the formless jhanas in particular, they are called what they are called a garuka karma. Do you remember that word? Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Garuka, heavy action. It means it has a strong mark on the psyche. Murder is one. Right? Formless jhanas for sure. So that at the time of death, those actions are so strong that they come up very quickly as part of the rebirth linking karma. Otherwise, habitual actions will rule the rebirth. We sort of just stop for a little while and then we leave the station and carry on in the same track. Or something gets us to change rails. Although it's not an I who does it or anything. But you understand what I'm saying here? So this experience is a very powerful or heavy, that's how it's usually translated, garuka, heavy action, so that it has such influence of in a way you could use the word blissfulness on the psyche, that immediately at the death moment, that is the impetus to just go to one of those states. So if you're in the state, it leads to rebirth in the plane of existence called the base of nothingness, the objective counterpart of the seventh meditative attainment. The mind just hovers there. Here the lifespan is supposed to be 60,000 eons. But of course, to the consciousness being there, you know, for us, you know, 70 years, for the consciousness being here, it's a life. For a mosquito, 70 years would be 60,000 eons. Right? But when that has elapsed, one must pass away and return to a lower world. Thus, one who attains this is still not free from birth and death, but is caught in the trap of Mara. Horner misses the point that rebirth is the issue by translating only as far as reaching the plane of no thing. But it's like if you are looking for the way to stop being subject to duality, then you would not want to be caught in subjective results. You know, like continuous. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and said to him, "Friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." Uddaka Ramaputta replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dharma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it himself, realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine." I soon quickly learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, "I know and see," And there were others who did likewise. So I'm just check the footnote, 303. Yeah, they have a mistake about the name in two other translations, so this guy's got the name right. So we'll leave that for now. I considered it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Oh, I'm sorry, I went back, didn't I? Oh, I didn't. Okay. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, "Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma?" In reply, Udaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the eighth of the eight jhanas, the final formless jhana. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, "Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma? By realizing for himself with direct knowledge?" "That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It's a gain for us, friend. It's a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one in our companion, one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, it's the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community." Thus Udaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, I left it and went away. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived in Senanigama near Uruvela. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, "This is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort that will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving." And I sat down there thinking this will serve for striving. So they leave out the whole part where he practiced trying to cut down desire in this one, but they cover it in another one. Enlightenment. Then, bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, seeking the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the unailing supreme security from bondage, I attained the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, seeking the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. being myself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision rose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. So you see, this experience happens after he has an experience of no subject. No subject. Realizing that the self is not permanent. And a definitive, clear experience of that with the neither perception nor non-perception, with the nothingness. No, clear, definitive experience. So then, seeking that which is not subject to, I find that which is not subject to. The I is a convenient word, denoting a wave in time and space, not a fixed entity. But there is an experience of that which is not I, therefore not subject. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's very beautiful. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning. Yep. You need some experience. Subtle to be experienced by the wise. So who is the wise? 305. This Dhamma with the Four Noble Truths, the two truths or states, Kana, spoken of just below, dependent origination and nibbana, are the truth of the origin of suffering and the cessation of suffering, which respectively imply the truths of suffering and the path. So the two truths were the first thing that the Buddha explained to the first group of people that he taught, and then he expanded it into the four truths. And so the two truths are suffering based on interdependent origination or dependent origination and the cessation of suffering. And also left out of here is the Buddha's, or maybe it has a little further on, before he went and taught, he spent 6 weeks, it's talked about, after having experienced no longer being subject, then he spent 6 weeks meditating on cause and effect, the wheel of dependent arising and the wheel of dependent dissolution, inner and outer. And some of the sutras, not this one particularly, but in other sutras, they spend some time describing that was when his energy fully opened to being a Buddha. When he understood, when he clearly contemplated coming into being and passing away based on dependent on ignorance arises, avijja, pachaya, sankhara, formations. You have to ignore something for something to take form, right?
In the space of ignoring it, you see it.
In the space of ignoring everything, you see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Explain that other stuff.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. I'm not getting that one.
So, look over in that corner. Now, without changing where you're looking at, what am I doing right now?
I can't see it.
Why? Yeah, you're ignoring here, you're looking there.
Right. Yeah.
So that corner comes alive.
Right.
Now, looking at me, do you see that fly banging against the wall in that corner?
No.
Why not? Because you're ignoring that, looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
Ignorance is a power.
So how did you say that again?
Dependent on ignorance arises formation. So the idea, this form comes because ignoring all the other possibilities, which we don't do when we're children. I use this image a lot. You know, when you're really young and you decide that you're going to take one of the kitchen chairs and turn it upside down and put a coat over it and it becomes your private little fort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not a chair, is it?
No.
Heavens no. It's your own private little place. Nobody can see you there, right? You could even take some cookies in there. And nobody would know. Right? Or your sister's doll. She doesn't know where you are. You don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, okay, you got to put the chair back. There's no chair here. Oh, you got my doll. You know? Poof! Ignorance is gone suddenly. Right? Whole new, you know, so like again, ignorance is very movable. But what happens with it is that we get accustomed to clinging to it, which creates dependent on ignorance arises formations. Formations arise, but then we actually think that those formations are actually inherently real. Right? Does that make sense? So then comes mind, body, I am, and this. And then the six senses, like you see a chair upside down. You don't see one right side up. And you have a whole experience with that, you know? I mean, I'm just glossing over, but is that straightforward?
Yeah.
So really, ignorance is a power as long as you don't get caught by thinking that because of using the power of ignorance, therefore it's true for all states of consciousness. Or, you know, that it's actually even true for this state of consciousness. Like they say in the Zen, you can't enter the same river twice. Oh, you can't even enter it once.
In a place of ignorance, you're open to learning too.
Absolutely.
If you know you're in the place of ignorance.
Yeah, and that's yeah. But we are always in the place of ignorance.
But there's times that you won't admit it.
Oh yeah, quite often I do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do it quite often.
So you actually fight to stay in that place too.
Yes.
If someone's trying to teach you something,
we can get really caught, can't we?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
And we don't even see that it's like suffering. What we're doing is suffering. That to learn something new is a joy. Like learning something new is a joy.
Yeah.
Because then you know what isn't reliable.
You know
what not to depend on.
I've seen that. I've seen that come and go at work. In trying to teach and now it just
it's clicking, yeah.
Yeah,
well, teaching, you really see it, don't you?
Yeah.
Or like watching people come into a job when you've been in it for a while. You really see that,
yeah.
You know? And you really realize that somebody is actually determined to hold on to their ignorance because they don't want to see another way.
Oh God, yeah.
You just like really appreciate them, step back, give them a little space, and see what you're going to learn from it. You know?
Yeah. And now I can find myself stepping back.
Yeah.
In the physical job, I can.
So isn't that nice? Isn't that
a
power?
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
So you see, that's like using ignorance without being caught in it. And the Buddha said, I too use concepts, I'm just not fooled by them.
Mm-hmm.
I too use ignorance, I just don't get caught by it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not subject to ignorance. So maybe it's like we got 8 minutes left, so maybe we'll get finished this paragraph. Where was I?
19,
yeah. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see, and hard to understand. It is, isn't it? Peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. Oh yeah, that's where we stop. So the one who understands the origin and the cessation of dissatisfactoriness, that's how who will understand this. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. And worldliness would mean, you know, not the subtle path, right? Not the 306. Alaya. Oh, yeah, great word. Difficult to find for this word a suitable English equivalent that has not already been assigned to a more frequently occurring Pali term. Horner renders it a sensual pleasure, which appropriates the usual rendering of kama. Kama as in sensuality. It may be too narrow. I think it's way too narrow for alaya. Alaya. In MS and in other published works, Nyanamoli translated as something to rely on. The meaning behind that would be more something that has happened in the past. That makes sense to you? Something that's part of the storehouse of memory, which may draw upon a connotation of the word that is not the one intended here. What?
They call adhesion here in this book?
Where? Read the sentence with that in, please.
This generation delights in adhesion, takes delight in adhesion, and rejoices in adhesion.
Oh, you're not in the footnote?
No.
Okay. Yeah, and that would make sense to me. That has a nice ring to it,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It does.
Delights in worldliness, delights in, unless you consider that the world means what we've already experienced, and therefore we call it the world. Because a lot, did you hear what I said, Kathy? Unless you consider that worldliness means what we've already experienced, this is in the world,
yeah.
And there's a certain known quality to it, because that's the adhesion that's there too, like clinging to the ignorance that is familiar, that identifies an I, you know, my house, my, you know, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an adhesion, absolutely. You can see how hard it is to interpret this word. Now, this is really going to be interesting, because wait until we get to the Empress tomorrow, because this is what the Empress is all about.
Because when you talk about it, I think of Velcro.
Yeah, and it is like Velcro, but it's also more than that. It's also, so here it is, renders it a sensual pleasure. Sensual pleasure, because that, you know, that's like Velcro, isn't it? Glue, for sure. And maybe too narrow. And in other published works, Nyanamoli translated as something to rely on. And you can see that that's true, too. Which may draw upon a connotation of the word that is not the one intended here. Alaya is explained in MA as comprising both objective sense pleasure and the thoughts of craving concerned with them. Now, isn't that interesting? How do you see that?
Well, you have the act and then all the thoughts around it. I mean, there's no escaping that in a way.
That's right. But you only identify it because there is some kind of already stored memory of having had an experience before or watching somebody have the experience. So it is always related to a past experience. It's not related to something you've never seen before. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point that I find most interesting about Alaya. Or Alaya. and this does it the best for me, both objective sense pleasures and the thoughts of craving concerned with them. So the object, and the inner subjective thoughts concerned with them. But that implies a storehouse of understanding, doesn't it? From who knows what lifetime. Some sense of familiarity, some sense of, right? Doesn't it?
Sort of that you're never going to see anything new.
Well, if you are, that's a tricky question. Can we leave that question for now? Because, I mean, certainly tomorrow night, I mean, this is Empress ground. This is Empress ground. And it might be easier for us to talk about it in terms of the Western mystery tradition. Because it will ring bells to you that this one, the language is just, you know, a little more slippery. But it's interesting, isn't it? The whole kind of grasp this. So, but this generation takes delight in, what is it? Adhesiveness?
Adhesion.
Adhesion,
yeah.
Or worldliness. You know? Because really your emotions or your meanings are like glue, aren't they? And when that glue is operating, there's going to be an object. Whether the object's actually there or not almost doesn't matter. You can project. Have you ever projected an object that wasn't there?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Oh. Haven't we all?
Mm-hmm.
You look somewhere, you thought you saw something, and then they weren't that person, or it wasn't that thing. Oh, I thought my boots were right there. Oh, those are your boots. You've never done that, though. Have you done that?
Yes.
Okay. Takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness, adhesion. It's hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it's hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachment, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Thereupon there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before, and this is where we're going to end tonight. Enough with teaching the Dhamma that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. Considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than teaching the Dhamma. And I think we'll end there. Just look at the footnote, because that's a good place to stop.
What did he teach, didn't he?
Leave it on a note of mystery, because none of us know, right? The question is raised, why, when the Bodhisattva had long ago made an aspiration to reach Buddhahood in order to liberate others, is mine now inclined toward inaction? The reason, the commentator says, is that only now, after reaching enlightenment, did he become fully cognizant of the strength of the defilements in people's minds. He had no idea what a big task it was. And of the profundity of the Dhamma. Also, he wanted Brahma to entreat him to teach so that beings who venerated Brahma would recognize the precious value of the Dhamma and desire to listen to it. So there you go. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
It's interesting when I read it here, or I hear it now, and how I can attach it to something in my recent past. Where did the hour and a half go?
Because it's meaningful.
Yeah. And trying to use the
And that's exactly what the Buddha is talking about in that footnote, isn't it? Like, it had meaning when you know, how would you teach something that doesn't have meaning to people?
Yeah.
But when it has meaning, you hear it.
Yeah, it's been fun. And reading a book, Nonviolent Communication, right now.
Ah.
And I've been performing on a crew for off and on now since I went up to Murray. And they've taken the radio away because I was getting the fights with the guys. But the people on my crew, I want to see some work done. And I have no problem saying, I want to see some work done. And the guys don't like it. You don't talk to me like that. Well, just get your ass out there and do something. If you don't want to work, then leave. It's as simple as that. And so they take the radio away. They keep paying me the foreman's rate. But now I'm back on the tools, with a higher rate of pay, working the way I want to work. And I'll work with apprentices, and the apprentices will come by and say, I see why people don't want to work with you. And I'll go, oh, okay. No, the temper is coming up between the two of us, and I can step, now at sometimes I can step back and just do my job,
right,
and leave them over there.
Yeah, and not get caught by it.
Yeah, and leave him there for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And he'll work, and he'll be stewing, and then when the work is just about done, I'll say, now that you had a couple hours to stew, I'll tell you why I wanted to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
If you wouldn't listen to me 2 hours ago.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, you wouldn't.
Yeah, but that doesn't help you saying that, does it?
No, it's explaining to him that to catch on to what's
going
on.
But why would you need to explain that to him?
Right.
Once he gets it, he'll understand.
Yeah, well, then he gets it. Then he sees, he actually sees the whole, he can go back in and he can walk back through the steps.
Yeah, but he can do that as soon as he understands, too. He doesn't need to know that you wouldn't listen to me 2 hours ago.
Sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I'll say it, sometimes I won't.
Oh, okay.
It depends on the situation, okay?
I was just wondering why one would need to say that, because you would both know that. You would both know that he wouldn't listen to you a minute ago, or 2 hours ago, or 17 years ago.
Yes and no. I can look at myself at the times that I wouldn't listen.
But like, if you won't listen, you won't listen. So that, you know, there's one part of yourself that knows that. Do you think I should let you off the hook here?
Hmm?
Do you think I should let you off the hook here?
I still missed it.
Do you think I should let you off the H-O-O-K here?
No, I'm just not understanding what you're...
I'm saying, why tell him what he already knows? Because you already know it too. Because that's not what you want to tell him. You're not trying to tell him that he wouldn't listen to you 2 hours ago. You're trying to tell him something about why you did do it, why you did prefer to do it that way.
Yeah. Okay.
And whether or not he was able to listen to you 2 hours ago, it has nothing to do with why you would prefer to do it, because you learned that preference before you met him. You learned that preference.
Yeah.
Before you met him.
Yeah.
So whether or not he was willing to listen to you 2 hours before has nothing to do with what you're trying to communicate. I'm just curious why, you know, out of somebody who's interested in non-confrontational communication, why that would be something you would want to say.
This is before I even knew this book existed.
But I'm saying... Still saying it. You're bringing it up in terms of this conversation, so I was just curious why you would say that to him. Because it's kind of confrontational, isn't it? It's sort of like saying, I was right and you were wrong.
Okay.
Isn't it?
No.
And don't you think that can be confrontational? Unless you actually say it with a lot of fun. I was right again, ha 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 ha, you buy the beer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's different than, well, you wouldn't listen to me too.
No, and I didn't do it in that tone or in that.
Fantastic.
I didn't do it in that tone. I did it in a place of teaching.
Good. Because, I mean, I know that, you know, that can really get up somebody's nose.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. And I know that. I'm coming beyond that.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to learn those things, and I'm sure that book must be very useful
mm-hmm.
for that.
Yeah, it's forcing me to look at myself from a different place.
Yeah. As a group. It's nice if we can look at each other as a group and look at ourselves as a group, as a member of a group.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are we done then?
Mm-hmm.
Wayne's going to fall asleep. Ron's going to fall asleep.
Heavy-duty yoga last night.
Huh?
So heavy-duty yoga last night.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How sweet is that?
Yeah.
So you notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts. I do. It spreads through your body. Through the room. Everywhere moves out. Anyone you're thinking of. You love, hate, admire, you want to pray for. Just imagine them being wrapped by that golden light. It spreads out everywhere. Wherever there's suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily washed, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. So thank you. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.